From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Koch once described the corporation he runs with his brother Charles as the biggest company you've never heard of. The Kochs prefer to fly under the radar, but over the years they've built the second largest private corporation in the U.S. The Kochs, though, are no longer so much under the radar. Over the last few decades, they've become famous for building a massive political network that pumps hundreds of millions of dollars into the system. The investigative reporter Daniel Shulman says it's money they're spending to remake the country's political landscape. Shulman has written a book that explores the Koch dynasty, and he's joining us today to talk about it. There are four brothers who play a part in this story, not just two, and Shulman wants to know what shapes them and drives them. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. With the exception maybe of Bill Koch, all the rest of the Koch brothers have tried to keep their business and political operations off the radar. But the fact is, the fact that you do recognize the Koch name is a testament to just how high profile it's become these days. The brothers David and Charles Koch are the principal players. They've built a massive private corporation that brings in more than $100 billion a year. But the part you've probably paid the most attention to is the political network they've constructed over the decades, a network that has pumped hundreds of millions of dollars into the system. The investigative journalist Daniel Shulman calls it an intellectual infrastructure to promote their libertarian ideology. Shulman has written a book about the Koch brothers. It's called Sons of Wichita. Wichita, Kansas is the headquarters for Koch Industries, and it's where much of the story plays out. He's joining us today, Daniel Shulman, to talk about the book, which profiles this family dynasty, not just the politics, though, but also the personal forces that shaped it. Daniel Shulman is a senior editor in the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones. He's also a founding member of their investigative journalism team. Sons of Wichita is his first book, and he's joining us today from NPR in Washington. And Daniel Shulman, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I wanted to start by kind of making this clear. The New York Times says that your book is closer to a family saga than a political expose. And reading the book, that seems about right. I think some are going to maybe sense that that's what it is an expose, but it's a biography. We should point that out.
Yeah, that was the intention of this book. And really one of the things that interested me in this family early on is you just heard so much about Charles and David Koch. Those were the Koch brothers. Mm. Of course, there's four Koch brothers. And in my, you know, as I began to research this family, I thought they're, you know, they've got obviously a fascinating political story, but their family story is just as interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned early in the book how, as you say, we've heard a lot about Charles and David as these kind of all-powerful political puppeteers. But you, I think you seem put off by this caricature because you say it only really bears a faint resemblance to reality. And you say there's this kind of mythology of the Kochs. What would you say the mythology is? How would you describe that?
You know, I think in the 2010 timeframe, you start to see these guys become, you know, these political demons. And they're the puppet masters between every, you know, conservative political cause. In some cases, there was some truth to it. In some cases, it was, you know, just outlandish. For instance, you know, in the Trayvon Martin case, there was a rumor going around at one point that they were funding George Zimmerman's legal defense, yeah. which of course was crazy. But in terms of, you know, the Tea Party, yeah, they played a major role in providing the financial and organizational support that got this movement off the ground, even though the Kochs and their representatives tried to distance themselves from that.
I want to ask you about this theme that I detected of combat, of fighting, because you mentioned that pugilism was this enduring theme in the lives of the Koch family. And you start with this story right off the bat, really, in the book, where David and Bill, they're these fraternal twins, young boys at the time, they're driven out to the outskirts of Wichita, to the Koch family property, and basically they're told to duke it out. Talk about this story and what that means in sort of the bigger sense of this idea of rivalry and fighting within the family.
Sure. So, you know, as they were growing up, Bill and David certainly had quite a sibling rivalry. Bill would later attribute this partially to their older brother, Charles, who he said really knew how to sort of provoke fights between these guys. And he says he was a bit of a mischievous bully type of character. But anyway, when the Koch brothers reached their teens, when David and Bill, the twins, reached their teens, their fights would in some cases be so violent that their caretaker at this time, the person who was driving the car in the scene that you're referencing, used to carry boxing gloves around with him.
Right.
So when they would get into it, when they would start arguing, you know, to diffuse these fights and keep these guys from really hurting each other, they'd put the boxing gloves on, duke it out, work it out of their systems, and go on their way.
Mm.
But this pugilistic theme carried through a lot, you know, everything from their politics to the way their father conducted his business. You know, one of the formative experiences of his life was being locked in essentially a couple decades of lawsuits with a company called Universal Oil Products, which had sued his company for patent infringement. And, you know, instead of knuckling under, he fought back against this company for more than 20 years.
You describe Bill and David as pathologically competitive. And as you say, that rivalry, that idea to push back and fight back has defined really the story, certainly the way Charles and David have, it seems anyway, and I wanted to get your sense of that, have constructed this, you know, political network, this business network. Not that it's all based on that fighting, but it's seems like an important undercurrent, I guess.
I think it is. I mean, the other thing is that these all of the brothers have a sort of stand your ground mentality, kind of a frontier mentality, and this traces back to their upbringing and their father's upbringing. He grew up in a very small town called Juana in the Texas Panhandle.
Yeah.
It was really one of the last frontiers at the time that their grandfather became one of its early settlers, and he was a successful local newspaperman there. So this really goes back a long ways, but you certainly see this in their politics and in their, I guess, their sort of refusal to be cowed by the Obama administration.
Daniel Shulman is with us. His book is called Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the investigative journalist Daniel Shulman. We're talking about his biography, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. Well, I guess where we were sort of left off was I'm really interested in the fact that Fred, the patriarch of the family, Fred Chase Koch, is this gifted student with this aptitude for science and math, and it's a gift that he passes on to his kids.
Absolutely. You know, as I was mentioning earlier, his father ran a local newspaper, and Fred Koch's brother actually goes into the newspaper business. But Fred decides that that's not the right way for him. You know, all around him at the time that he's growing up in the, you know, the early 1900s, the world is changing rapidly. There goes from being, you know, a few hundred cars on the road to millions. And so there's a huge national thirst for gasoline at this time. He goes first to Rice University and then to MIT to study chemical engineering, focusing on petroleum engineering.
Yeah.
And later on, Charles, David, and Bill would go to MIT and also study engineering. In fact, Bill would get a PhD in chemical engineering there, and all of them would get advanced degrees from MIT.
He was particularly – Fred Koch, the patriarch, was particularly – right wing in his ideology, and even for the time he was. You mentioned, and of course, that he becomes one of the founding members of the John Birch Society of 1958, which wasn't well thought of within the establishment. I guess, again, continuing this theme of sort of pushing up against the establishment or fighting back, he really stood out, I guess, for his right wing politics.
He absolutely did. And, you know, the John Birch Society itself, just to remind people who they were, this was this right-wing organization that really saw the menace of communism behind everything. You know, they believed that the unions had been infiltrated by communists. They believed that the civil rights movement had been infiltrated by communists, that Martin Luther King was a communist, that the Soviets were intentionally trying to stir up race tensions in the United States in order to pave the way for a takeover. Robert Welch, who was the founder of the John Birch Society, had written in this one treatise that he believed that Dwight Eisenhower, the president at that time in the late 50s, said what they believed, that he believed that he was a quote unquote conscious agent of the Soviets.
Right.
So basically a sleeper agent.
Exactly. You know, what's so interesting about this, though, is that a lot of people who are within, you know, the red baiting movement had these sort of abstract ideas about communism. But it's important to point out that Fred Koch has a very real experience with communism. And I wanted you to talk about this, because what he sees in the Soviet Union has a profound impact on him.
Absolutely. So basically, we'll go back a couple decades. So in the 1920s, he starts this oil engineering firm in Wichita. He and his partners are very quickly sued by a company called Universal Oil Products for infringing their patent on a refining process. Universal Oil Products has a pretty good case that they were, you know, sort of pirating this technology, because Fred's business partners, initial business partners, actually were Universal Oil Products employees who had left the company and were intimately familiar with this technology that they were selling. So they're relentlessly sued in the United States, have to look overseas for contracts. Their first major coup is in Stalin's Soviet Union, where they're paid $5 million to basically help modernize 15 refineries and fuel the industrialization of the Soviet Union. And this was controversial at that time, because the United States did not have diplomatic relations with the USSR at that point at all. Fred Koch spends 3 months over there overseeing the work that his company is doing, and is just absolutely horrified by what he sees there. You know, people are being issued a half a bar of soap a month, and, you know, they've got these coupons redeemable for, you know, one shirt. I mean, he's just appalled by the lack of freedom there. He returns home vowing to do everything he can to fight the spread of communism. And he'd had this kind of Bolshevik minder when he was there, who's sort of warning him about what's going to happen. And as, you know, in a letter that I found that Fred Koch wrote, he wrote that this minder kind of shook his fist at him as he was leaving to go back to the United States, and basically said, I'll see you in the U.S. sooner than you think.
Right.
and so this experience really casts a shadow over the rest of his life as he sees, you know, this communist conspiracy slowly coming true in the United States. So that's the background of where all this John Birch Society stuff had come from.
Writes a book called A Businessman Looks at Communism. Was it very popular at the time, or was this just one of those things that he figured he could, so he did?
I think he thought, you know, the way it got started, is that he gave a talk. You know, he was kind of speechifying on anti-communist matters. He gave a talk over a radio station. There was such demand that he decided to actually turn it into a pamphlet. And at first, he just mailed it around to, you know, a lot of folks in Kansas. It was quite popular. I think in the end, you know, millions of copies were printed. And what's interesting is I got a hold of Fred Koch's FBI file, and this pamphlet very quickly made it to the attention of the authorities because he was making all sorts of allegations about the communist conspiracy, and you know, it would be very easy for the communists to take over if they just assassinated the president or something like that. There were a lot of Americans who wrote into the FBI saying, you know, who is this Fred Koch guy? Is there, you know, is there any truth to these allegations that he's making? So it was quite interesting. But his pamphlet really made the rounds, and there were a huge amount of people on the right that read it during his era.
Do we have – what kind of sense do we have of the effect that all of this had on his sons? I mean, you write about the fact that – and we'll get into the particulars of this as we go – his second son, Charles, who becomes sort of overshadows the first son, Frederick, he seems pretty influenced by this conservative ideology at first. But – and this is really interesting and something we'll talk more about. Charles really has this sort of anti-war philosophy that emerges. Mm-hmm. And he keeps, as a matter of fact. Vietnam has an influence over him, and it seems like this was a transformative moment for Charles. He buys what his father says for a while, but the war made him go in another direction. And maybe these are the beginnings of a sort of libertarian perspective?
Well, so what really happens is, you know, Charles Koch becomes a member of the John Birch Society, like his dad.
Yeah.
But he's not this – he's not – really as paranoid as his dad is about communism, although he believes it's a huge issue.
Sure.
To just give you a sense of what was happening in the Koch family home during that era, you know, someone who visited the home told me that he comes to the door one time, knocks, Charles answers, and this person is carrying a copy of Ernest Hemingway's Sun Also Rises. And Charles looks at the book, and this visitor can tell that there's something wrong, and he asks, is everything okay? And Charles says, well, you can't bring that book into the house.
Right.
And the visitor just is kind of shocked. He's like, what do you mean? And Charles explains that, well, Ernest Hemingway is a communist. Communist literature cannot come into our home. You know, you got to leave it on the stoop.
Yeah.
So that's kind of – I mean, he certainly was buying into some of this stuff. Now, what happens is that at the top tier of the John Birch Society, you have some individuals who – become involved with a school, something called the Freedom School,
right,
which was basically this training ground for libertarians at the very, you know, at the very beginning of that movement. That holds seminars in the Rampart Mountain Range of Colorado. The guru behind this is this guy named Bob LaFave, who is essentially, you know, an anti-government activist. And also, you know, he's the local op-ed editor of a paper there in Colorado. So that's sort of how he ends up kind of bridging that gap between the John Birch Society and the fledgling libertarian movement. Mm. Now, you were mentioning Vietnam. What causes the split between the John Birch Society types and the libertarian types is very much the war.
Right.
LaFave and the libertarians were preaching, you know, pacifism. And Charles really bought into that that ideology, this libertarian ideology, unbridled, of unbridled freedom, and also, no military interventions and things of that nature.
Yeah.
His split with the John Birch Society comes when he and another John Birch Society member run an anti-Vietnam War ad in the Wichita Eagle and are subsequently basically pushed out of the organization because of that. And that begins his sort of long journey to mainstreaming libertarian, right, you know, the libertarian ideology.
I think this may be one of the things that may surprise most people about the Koch brothers. But again, based on that sort of knee-jerk caricature of them, they may be surprised to know, and you talk about this, that David and Charles Koch in particular are very much depart from the Republican Party on most social issues. David has talked about being pro-gay marriage. They're more in line with, frankly, the left, with liberals on civil liberties, you've pointed out, on immigration, war we've talked about, reproductive rights as well. I mean, this is very libertarian, their perspective.
Yeah, and, you know, the Libertarian Party, the Libertarian movement of the 70s, really, the goal was to unite left and right,
yeah,
through this third third way, essentially. It never quite succeeded because I think on the left, you really couldn't find people that wanted to dismantle the welfare state or get rid of the income tax or things like that, which are really, you know, core libertarian beliefs, they weren't buying into these free market ideas. But certainly on issues of civil liberties and, you know, even drug legalization and things like that, you really had this area where right and left could unite. I think it's interesting right now that they're viewed as such Republican power brokers. And of course they are. But on a number of key issues, you named them, they do not align with the Republicans.
I want to back up a little bit and just sort of lay out the characters. I mean, we've talked about Charles, we've talked about David, and we'll get back to them, of course, because they're obviously crucial for the story. Let's talk a little bit about the other two. Let's start with Frederick, who seems in some way kind of the odd man out in the family in some ways. He's a lover of theater and literature, and as you put it in the book, he leaves Wichita for boarding school in the Northeast, and he really doesn't look back. Talk about Frederick.
Yeah, so Frederick is the eldest of the Koch brothers. He's you know, the patriarch was just plain old Fred, but I think they gave their first son a more refined twist to his name that really fits his personality. And he was a lover of theater, a lover of the arts. He really took after their mother's interests. She was an artist herself. And you know, their dad was a John Wayne-esque figure. Man's man, tough love sort of guy. He'd come up and they didn't have a lot of money when he was growing up, and suddenly became very wealthy. And he was very afraid of what his wealth would do to his sons. So he worked them incredibly hard, including on these ranches that he had bought in the 1940s and 1950s. Now Charles has said that Frederick really did not do well with this backbreaking manual labor and rebelled against this. So that's one of the reasons why he might have been the odd man out, but he has certainly always been sort of on the periphery. Now the other lesser known brother is Bill.
Wait, back up for just a minute. Cause sure. I just want to say something more about Frederick before we move on to Bill. Bill's a great character too. There's this part of, you talk about how Frederick really conducts his life and still this way incredibly privately. So much so you say he almost seems to be striving for obscurity. And then you tell this intriguing story near the end of the book of this time where it's kind of cryptic, I have to say, in some way, but where you have this, or you're going to have, or you try to set up this interview with Frederick, and it seems like it actually may happen. And he gets you into his townhouse or wherever it might have been, and then he says, okay, I'll talk to you, but you've got to sign this contract. Do you want to tell that story?
Yeah. So, I mean, essentially, you know, when I started this project, I sent letters to all of the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
Explaining what I was trying to do and that I wanted to do, you know, a straightforward biography of this really, you know, what I view as just an incredibly important family. And so of them, Frederick was the one who responded personally. I you know, in terms of the Koch Industries people, I quickly got into a dialogue with them. But Frederick responded personally.
Wow.
And one of the things that he was intrigued by, I think, is that I'd found his master's thesis at Yale, where he studied playwriting, and he'd done an adaptation of a book, a musical theater adaptation of a book called No Bed for Bacon. Now, No Bed for Bacon, just to give people an idea, would later be part of the inspiration for the movie Shakespeare in Love, which I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. So I'd mentioned all this in my letter. He gave me a call, and we had a very nice chat. He invited me over and, you know, gives me just a really lovely tour of this this mansion he owns on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. What's interesting is that he doesn't actually even live there.
Right.
He's got another apartment down the street. This is just where he keeps all of this jaw-dropping art. And this place that he owns actually was given its origin. It was a wedding gift to one of the youngest daughter of the dime store magnate, Woolworth.
Yeah.
And he built this place for his daughter.
And Frederick, you know, loves to tell the story, right? I mean, you said that's part of his character.
He's just a very raconteurish character, and he's got all this art. I mean, he's really got I mean, someone said this to me, but he does have the mind of a scholar, and he loves to tell the stories behind all of this artwork he has. I mean, one of the pieces he has in his home is, you know, this bed, this canopied bed that was given to Marie Antoinette on her wedding day by the mayor of Paris. Wow. Just amazing stuff. So basically what ends up happening is, you know, we spend this time together and we sit down to kind of, you know, he says, you know, shall we delve into Coke World?
Right.
It's, you know, and he takes out this document, this very crisp typewritten document from this binder he has, and slides it over to me. And it's basically a contract saying that, you know, not only anything he tells me, but anything that secondary sources or, you know, third-party research materials, any of that would have to be cleared with him before being published. And obviously that was not something that I could agree to. And that's where our sort of relationship had to end.
Right. Nice try, I guess. Let's talk about Bill Koch, because much of the direction of his life seems to have been driven by what we were talking about before, that rivalry and what you called these childhood resentments. Let's talk about Bill Koch. He's certainly much more flamboyant than the rest of his brothers.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and Bill Koch grew up feeling kind of, you know, like the third or lesser wheel of this brotherly triumvirate of Charles and David and Bill. He was, you know, all of the Koch brothers, Charles, David, and Bill are very tall. Frederick's not as tall, but Bill really sprouted up, and he was just kind of a gawky, awkward kid. And he also just had a real temper. You know, David has told stories about Bill kind of going nuts and, stabbing him in the back with this African ceremonial sword that their dad brought back from one of his adventures. And, you know, there's other stories of him brandishing a butcher knife and things of that nature. But things got so bad that their parents actually, you know, sent Charles away to boarding school at a very early age because they'd been told by a psychologist that they had to remove the source of Bill's burning resentment, and that was Charles. So that's kind of how these guys grow up. And, you know, when they later reunite at MIT, because all these guys end up going to boarding school for their teen years, when they later reunite at MIT, you know, things are copacetic for a while, but a lot of these hostilities start boiling up once again when these three brothers are working for the family company. Now, in terms of his personal life, Bill would go on to be best known for these messy entanglements, romantic, legal, and as a collector of all sorts of kind of fantastic stuff, including fine wines. He's been engaged recently in a number of lawsuits having to do with counterfeit wine he had bought years ago. He had bought some bottles of Bordeaux that were said to have been in Thomas Jefferson's wine cellar. Right. And it turns out that they were just, you know, forgeries.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Charles Koch, we'll come back to Bill when we talk about the fights, because that's an important part of the story.
Sure.
Charles Koch, the second son, really, he's the successor for Fred Koch in many ways. And you mentioned in the book how Fred Koch molded him from an early age. This is interesting. You call Charles powerful, but you also say he is unfailingly humble. You say that he's elusive, but also uncomplicated. And you put it this way. You say thoroughly Kansan, which I think, again, goes counter to this idea of him as this evil kind of caricature. But you get the sense that in many ways, whatever you think of his politics or whatever you think about anything else, you have a kind of an affection for Charles. Is that fair to say?
You know, I think that Charles has had an extraordinarily impressive business career. And just from – if you just look at what he's done politically, you have to admire this long political game that he's played, because it's been decades. And he's built, his political network the same way he's built his business. which has been, you know, pretty methodically. So I find him to be just a really interesting character. Here's a guy who, you know, he could really live wherever he wants to in the world. But he lives in Wichita, Kansas, on the same compound where he grew up. Basically, it's a place that's surrounded by, you know, all sorts of strip malls. Certainly not the nicest place in the world.
Yeah.
A fairly understated life. He doesn't like calling attention to himself. It was a struggle, in fact, a few years ago when Wichita State University wanted to, you know, they were going to make a big donation for the new stadium there, and they were going to call it the Charles Koch Arena. Charles Koch, in fact, finds that sort of, bringing that sort of attention upon himself to be an embarrassment. And so those are some of the things that I mean. And he certainly got a bit of a cult of personality around the Koch Industries headquarters where, you know, employees will see him just lining up in the
cafeteria.
That is Daniel Shulman is with us, of course. His book is called Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. We'll talk a little bit more about Charles Koch and his philosophy that comes to define Koch Industries when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Daniel Shulman. We're talking about his new book, Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. I should point out, as if you can't tell, that we've had a couple of technical difficulties, so just bear with us. Daniel Shulman is joining us from the studios of NPR in Washington. So let's talk a little bit about Charles Koch, who really seems like he's the mastermind, I suppose, of this management philosophy that comes to define Koch Industries. And I wanted you to break it down for us because it's very much, as you describe in the book, focused on the bottom line. Charles, you say, had this firm belief in the power of markets to guide human behavior. So he creates this, this system.
Yeah, the engine that Koch Industries runs on is Charles's management philosophy, which is called market-based management. And really, in the simplest form, he's trying to create a free market microcosm within his company. So, for instance, you'll have various divisions that will trade amongst each other for the various, you know, services and things of that nature.
Right.
But he's also tried to push decision making down to the lowest levels and to imbue his employees with the idea that they're just not just worker drones, but they're entrepreneurs in their own right. He wants them to take some sort of feeling of ownership. And the way he does that is through, essentially employees are given quite a bit of, you know, instead of property rights, as you would have in a free society, they have what's called decision rights. And the more value you bring to the company, the more decision-making power you will have. But this extends even to people that are sort of in the mailroom. If you can kind of figure out a new way to do your job that's quicker, more efficient, adds more value to the company, you know, you will be compensated for that. So that's a bit about how this place runs, but it's a very much a libertarian tinged ethos that is diffused throughout the company.
And he finds a kindred spirit in his kid brother, David. David Koch becomes Charles' loyal wingman, is how you put it. Talk about their relationship. And let's say something about David. He doesn't end up staying in Wichita. He sets his roots in New York City, which is interesting. Talk about David Koch.
Yeah, David Koch and David and Charles Koch, they're all often seen as this sort of monolith, but these are two very, very different guys.
Yeah.
You know, David is really the sort of fun-loving playboy type character. And he, you know, he's sort of the man about town in New York City. He loves the theater. He loves, you know, to go out to all of these society events, things that Charles Koch absolutely, you know, hates. So in their relationship, the interesting thing is that he really becomes more of the face man for their political activities, though the strategy is really emanating from Charles and their main political advisor, a guy named Richard Fink. But David Koch really becomes the face of this, and you see this going back to the 1970s when David Koch runs for the Libertarian Party vice president on the Libertarian Party vice presidential ticket, and it actually had been Charles that asked if he would want to do this. And it carried through to, you know, David's role today with Americans for Prosperity, which is their flagship advocacy group.
It's interesting. One of the important themes in the book that you write about a little bit later is you say that Charles and David may have like-minded political beliefs, but you say history is going to judge them each differently. David, you say, he's really the true philanthropist. Charles, it seems, at least from your reporting, not so much. That's one of the insights that you seem to have sort of come to in the book.
As one person who knows them well said to me, David wants to save the world. Charles wants to change the world. And so Charles's philanthropic legacy, and this is something that he decided many decades ago, is the mainstreaming of the libertarian ideology. And he's done this through, methodical institution building of think tanks, advocacy groups, things of that nature. David Koch has, of course, donated to many of these causes, but his interests really lie elsewhere. In fact, before he was giving in the political sphere, he was mainly interested in giving to sort of archaeologists, people that were discovering the origins of man. Mm-hmm. That was his interest. And today, you know, the bulk of his giving really goes to the arts and medical research. He's given hundreds of millions of dollars to these causes. I was in New York the other day, and it's hard to walk down the street there without, you know, not seeing a major cultural landmark that David Koch doesn't have his name on. You know, you've got the David Koch Theater at Lincoln Center. He's given quite a bit of money to rehab the plaza outside of the Metropolitan Museum. His name is on the dinosaur wing at the Natural History Museum. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a bit of difference in their philanthropy.
I wonder what David would think about the idea that if people thought his legacy was all political, because it seems like you get a sense that that's not at all how he wants to be remembered. And in fact, and you even write about this in the book, the idea of what the company at large thinks about the Koch brothers' political involvement, because you say in the book that one Koch veteran told you that a lot in the company, and here's the quote, never understood why they got involved with politics to begin with.
Right. I think there are a lot of people at the company that just want to just do their jobs and don't know, you know, the vilification of the Kochs and of Koch Industries, this radioactive reputation that the company has gotten. Mm-hmm. They just think that, you know, why are we bothering with this political stuff that's dragging our names through the news and through the mud? Why are we doing this? And so I think that the Koch Industries of the future will probably be a lot less of a political place, you know, once really Charles is no longer really involved with running the company.
Mm. What influence do you figure they've had over the Republican Party? You mentioned the party really wasn't welcome in the Koch family wasn't really welcome in the Republican Party for years and years. But now I get a sense you figure that they have had a profound influence on the party itself, weakened the structures of the party in many ways. I mean, if the idea for Charles and or David is to infuse this idea of libertarianism within the party, it seems like they may have succeeded, at least in some ways.
You know, I think it's an ongoing process. But if you look at today's Republican Party, rising stars like a Rand Paul, there is definitely a libertarian streak. Now, the Kochs having amassed this influence within the Republican Party is a fairly new thing. They've long had a fairly uneasy relationship with the Republican Party, as you note. In fact, it's interesting, the National Review, going back to Fred Koch's day, you know, took it upon itself to eviscerate Robert Welch, the Birch Society founder, in order to save the conservative movement from going all kooky. Now, the National Review later plays this role when Charles is a major funder of the libertarian movement and, you know, basically attacks him and the libertarian movement in the late 1970s. Now, of course, the National Review is quick to come to the Koch brothers' defense these days. So that shows you a little bit of where they've come. But in some ways, when the Democrats started demonizing the Kochs, a mythology, and this is what we were talking about a little bit earlier, rose up around these guys. I think a lot of Republicans that weren't natural allies for the Kochs were rallied a bit to their cause by this. They've also, you know, in this new post-Citizens United world, the Kochs have really pioneered something that I think we'll see more and more, which is the decentralization of party power into the hands of wealthy individuals who in their case, you know, they've got a network of, you know, a few hundred high net worth individuals who, you know, raise money and channel it into, you know, the political causes of their choosing. But the Kochs really control a political network that, in terms of its fundraising prowess, its ability to raise to run ads, to rally voters, is very much on par with the Republican National Committee itself. One interesting number is that, you know, they raised $400 million in the 2012 election cycle.
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly how much the Republican National Committee raised.
Right. I want to come back to this idea of the family rivalry. The fight in the 80s and 90s between the brothers really is centered on Bill in many ways. He lines up this group of shareholders, a group who's not entirely crazy about the way the company is being run. He gets the older brother, Frederick, involved. And you write a lot about this this battle, I guess. But then there's this moment of that's really revealing. It comes in April of 1998 in the Frank Carlson Federal Building in Topeka, Kansas. And it's a bitter kind of reunion is how you describe it, because for the first time in years, they're all in the same place. They're all in the same time zone. And David Koch is giving testimony, I guess, during this deposition or during this trial. And it's a remarkably kind of poignant moment that you tell in the story. And I wanted you to talk about that.
Sure. So David Koch is asked about the circumstances of his brother's firing. And, you know, long story short, Bill, Frederick, and a group of shareholders, most of them members of the company, had attempted to take control of the board in 1980. Bill is very quickly fired for this. And, you know, in the boardroom that day, when they had to make the decision over his firing, David was just unable to raise his hand in favor of this. He knew that by voting his brother out of the company, and Charles had no qualms doing this, you know, he was more than happy to get rid of Bill. But David realized that by raising his hand that day, he would be not just voting him out of the company, but he would be in effect voting him out of his life. And so On the witness stand, all these years later, these emotions come flooding back for David, and he just basically says, "You know, I knew Bill had to go, but I just couldn't bring myself to vote against him. You know, this was my brother."
Mm-hmm.
So you know, there was a lot of these emotional moments. And what I found so fascinating when I was researching the book is that here's the most private, some would say secretive, of families. And a lot of their most intimate personal drama ends up playing out in the most public of settings, these courtrooms. And it's incredibly powerful.
I wanted to ask you about you mentioned this before. You said one former Koch executive told you that the Koch brothers likely won't repeat the errors that they made in 2012. Because you mentioned that in many ways it was probably a net loss for the Koch brothers, the 2012 election, so important to Charles, leaves them with this reputation as cartoonish robber barons, as you say in the book. But Charles, at least, and David don't seem to be backing away. You say in some ways they're probably digging in, do you figure?
Absolutely. It's just not in these guys' genetic makeup, in fact, to back down in the face of this sort of adversary, and the fact of the matter is just the attacks on them really just seem to, A, rally more people to them and fire them up to double down, which is absolutely what they're doing right now in advance of the midterm elections. They're expected to raise $300 million to dump into the midterms, which is just a really unprecedented amount of money. And they're, after this major failure in 2012, and it was just a major failure in which, a lot of this money ended up going into the pockets of political consultants that didn't get them much in the end. So I think right now, and this is something that holds true of the company, is these guys learn very quick from their mistakes, and they're not afraid to, blow something up and start from scratch if they think that's going to be more effective. So what you see going on right now is a lot of retooling within their political network. And one of the problems the last time this Tea Party movement sort of came back to bite them a bit, in 2012, you had these Tea Party-backed candidates that just flamed out in epic fashion with, comments about legitimate rape and things of that nature that not only had effects on, the Todd Akin race in Missouri, the Richard Murdoch race in Indiana, but had blowback across a number of other races. Now, what you see them doing now is getting much more involved in the recruitment and grooming of candidates. That's the future for them.
Do you think the future for the Republican Party, if then the Koch brothers are influential, do you think is a backing away from what seems to have been such attention to social issues, abortion rights, reproductive rights, those kinds of social issues? Do you think that's part of the future of the Republican Party, at least if the Kochs have anything to say about it?
It's so hard to say because there's such a social conservative strain within the party, mm-hmm. and it seems difficult to imagine a time when they will repudiate some of these positions. But one good example is immigration. The Kochs kind of dipped a toe into that debate, and they're moderate on this. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they did, they were attacked from the right. For being pro amnesty and things of that nature. But the fact is, and a lot of people are reading a lot into the outcome of this Eric Cantor race, where a lot of this had to do with his opponent really attacked him over his stance on immigration. Does this mean immigration reform is dead? Well, I think that the Republicans are going to have a major demographic problem. I mean, reform absolutely needs to get done in order to give the Republicans a better chance in 2016.
You mentioned in the book how despite Charles' careful control of all of this, the legacy is still up in the air for the Koch influence. I wonder, one of the things, and you just talked about this, if Koch Industries is this, as you call it, this deeply personal creation that embodies Charles Koch, what happens when he's gone? Is the company positioned to, and is the political wing, is that positioned to really stay the course?
I mean, the interesting thing about Koch Industries is it is just such a reflection of Charles's values and his beliefs. Market-based management was basically his effort to infuse his, persona almost into every crevice of the company. And, people throughout Koch Industries are trained in this. So that's one way to sort of keep his spirit alive within the company. His legacy will definitely live on too, through this really robust intellectual infrastructure he's helped to build and finance. I think whether the political network is as potent, you know, that's a little bit more of an open question.
Mm. I wanted to ask you this finally, and I've got about a minute left. This kind of a rosebud sort of symbol, this item that was kind of a sticking point in the relationship between the brothers, this portrait of their father. We've got about a minute left, so maybe not enough time to talk about this, but that seemed like kind of an interesting symbol for you.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that these brothers were fighting about was their father's, some of their father's possessions, including his artwork, and in particular this portrait of their dad that hung in the family home. Now, when they were talking about this dispute over, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, Bill and Charles were fighting over, you know, who got to keep the portrait. And eventually Bill, you know, let it go. And it's currently hanging in Charles Koch's office, you know, to the right of his desk, which is kind of symbolic, I think, because, you know, you've got the father, you know, looking over his heir apparent every day.
Daniel Shulman, senior editor and investigative journalist for Mother Jones. His book is called Sons of Wichita, How the Koch Brothers Became America's Most Powerful and Private Dynasty. Daniel Shulman, thank you very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.